Hi, and welcome to Holden Village. Today is Tuesday, June 25th, 1996. In the fireside room this morning, our speaker is Dan Spencer, continuing his series on lesbian and gay journeys of faith from exile to hope. Let's listen in.
My name is Dan Spencer, and this is the second in a five-part series called Lesbian and Gay Journeys of Faith. The title of today's session is called From Exile to Hope. And I took great inspiration from Barbara Rossi. I wish I also took her singing voice, but I don't have it. Last week when she was doing, or the last couple of weeks when she's been doing Bible studies, she has been starting and closing with hymn singing that relate to the theme. And I put out the Gather hymnals here, and I'd like you to turn to 427. I've told lots of people that this is I want the refrain from this to be on my epitaph of my tombstone, should I have a tombstone, because I love this traditional hymn, How Can I Keep From Singing? And thought we'd start with the first couple verses and then we'll close later with the last couple verses, because it's a wonderful movement that I want to trace today from exile to hope. Many of you know the story behind this particular hymn. My understanding is that it was an abolitionist hymn. It came out of the abolitionist movement, particularly with the Quakers, and was written while an abolitionist was in prison, far from loved ones, for the struggle for justice to abolish slavery. And so that sense of being exiled into prison and yet keeping the hope present and moving from exile to hope there. That's what I'd like to trace for today in terms of how lesbian and gay experiences of being in exile from homophobia are moving from exile to hope, and where that hope is found and how that touches biblical themes. Let me ask, who are good singers in the group here? Don't be bashful. We got some. Yes, we got a voice teacher upstairs here. Okay, good. Well, enough that we can carry the tune. I often say in many communities it's much easier for me to be out as gay than it is to be out as a singer. I love to sing, so I'm going to encourage us. And let me just to tap out the starting note here. This. Starting note here.
My life goes on.
I love the refrain on this, that particularly since love is Lord of heaven and earth, how can I keep from singing? It dovetails so nicely, I think, with both the joy and pain of much experience of lesbian and gay people. Part of our oppression, I think, is relatively unique when we look at the different kinds of oppression and discrimination in our world, because we are oppressed and discriminated against because of the way we love. It's because of how we experience love and how we choose to act on that love that ends up oftentimes separating us and sending us into exile. And yet, if any of you have ever been in the experience of being in love, you know that when you're in love, how can you keep from singing? It's that incredible dimension of our relationships that grasps us and takes us to our very core. And so this tension between being grasped by love, being in love, wanting to sing out, but being in communities that ask us to remain silent or separate, that sets up the tension, I think, for many lesbians, gay men, and bisexual persons. So we'll come back to that theme there. Is as a result of this, I think for many of our stories, the biblical themes of exile, particularly as Israel goes into exile and asks, how can we sing the Lord's song in a strange land? How can we sing when one is in exile? Speak very meaningfully to lesbians and gay men. So I'd like to do an opening quote from an absolutely delightful book that I've read for years now. I strongly encourage people, called Embracing the Exile: Healing Journeys of Gay Christians by John Fortunato. And there's some delightful things in here, and I'll be reading from a few of them here. But he has one quote here that I thought was helpful when we talked yesterday about it's the separation between sexuality and spirituality that oftentimes drives a wedge not only for gay people, but for many of us that needs to be healed. And Fortunato writes, he says, for gay Christians to be able to love, give, and find meaning in a world that rejects and isolates them, the cruel gash separating their sexuality from their spirituality must be healed. Their freedom to love and give in a hostile world hinges upon their coming to believe in their wholeness and in their having a rightful place in God's universe. That latter part there, believing that we actually are part of God's good creation, I think is one of the most difficult steps for many gay people to come to terms with. Most of us start our journeys alone, and oftentimes believing that we are the only person in the world who struggles with these feelings. Not having any sense, you start in isolation, and it's a long process to be able to first even imagine and then let alone claim that we are also part of God's good creation. So that journey from being exiled, moving into home and community is what I'd like to talk about today. And I'd like to deal with two sections. I'm going to talk that I think that the main factor that forces so many of us into exile is the phenomenon of homophobia. What we'll talk about later is this irrational or non-rational fear of homosexual feelings and orientations or persons who are homosexual, and the different social manifestations that happen from that. So I want to take a look at what it is that causes homophobia, where it's from, how all of us experience it. And then from there, take a look at the biblical themes that speak meaningfully to lesbian and gay experience about being in exile. How does one find meaning in exile? And with hope, then, how do we move from exile to reclaiming home and community? Let me start by reading another section here from, there are, as I mentioned before, there are a wealth of wonderful books both in the bookstore and in the library. And if people want to study more about the phenomenon of homophobia, I think an excellent book here is Suzanne Farr's book, Homophobia, A Weapon of Sexism, where she directly connects the fear of homosexuality with the fear and prejudice in sexism, gender and sexuality issues connecting. And she has she talks specifically on her last chapter called Women in Exile, The Lesbian Experience. I want to say a couple things. I can only speak out of my experience as a gay man, but I'm also in a lot of community with close lesbian friends. So while I can't represent lesbian experience, I want to be sensitive to where there are points in common and where there are differences there, and not pretend to be speaking for lesbians. But she, in this experience about talking about the lesbian experience in exile, she highlights things that I think are common to both lesbians and gay men. She writes, when giving workshops on internalized homophobia, I often ask all the lesbians who grew up in that city or that area to hold up their hands. Almost always, the number is fewer than 25%, often fewer than 10%. When I ask the others why they left their childhood homes and families, the majority say that they had to leave in order to find a place where they could live with some freedom as lesbians. They were seeking wholeness. They speak of missing close connections with family loved ones, of seeking a sense of community, of creating families. fearing loss of their families and communities if they stayed among them, identified as lesbians, they left so that they could live a little more visibly in a place where they were not known. They are in exile, seeking freedom. Many of the lesbians I meet have been deeply wounded by the ravages of homophobia. Some have told their families they were lesbian and were rejected. Others were accepted, but only conditionally so. Some have lost jobs, lost custody of their children, lost acceptance in the church of their choice, lost friends. Others have been incarcerated in prisons or mental institutions. Some have left their homes and families to live far away, only to learn that there is little acceptance of their sexual identity anywhere. Feeling so much alienation from the heterosexual world, many have put all their hopes and needs into their love relationships or their lesbian communities, and then have felt anger and despair when both of these showed human failings. Some have lived defiantly in the face of homophobia. Others have chosen complete invisibility. All have been touched by homophobia, even those who with great courage have lived their lives openly as lesbians and maintain good self-esteem and achieve success in their work and home lives. What I have found in these workshops is that lesbians are survivors. Individually, we are also miracles of survival. In the face of society's homophobia, we constantly assess our safety and determine how visible we can be at any one moment. We ask ourselves, how much of myself can I put forward in this moment? Is this friend trustworthy? Will this stranger physically attack me? What will be the response if these people know? Homophobia causes us to engage in a constant juggling act of our identity in order to survive. And yet we do, and most of us manage to maintain sanity and health. Well, she goes on, I think, to speak very eloquently about the different ways this happened, and I'd like to talk about that some more today. But what I'd like to focus on first is what exactly is homophobia? How does it operate? How does it affect each of us, and in what kinds of ways? And what are some of the risks in that? So I'm going to put out a few opening definitions, and then we're going to brainstorm some examples together. I want to mention one other book here. Well, I'm going to mention a few of them during the thing. This is the book, when anybody ever asks me if there were one book you would recommend, for people of faith, this is the one book I recommend. I find this book just phenomenal, called Can Homophobia Be Cured? It's a wonderful twist. Usually the question is asked, can homosexuality be cured? But this says, can homophobia be cured? Wrestling with questions that challenge the church, by Bruce Hilton, who has a gay child. And he also writes with a delightful sense of humor. It's written in a question-answer format, and virtually any question you can come up with, he has in here. But he starts off his book by saying, homophobia, an ugly word. Nobody likes it. The disease itself is pretty ugly, too. I've had a case of it since I was a little kid. Chances are you have, too. It's so universal and so taken for granted that most of us aren't even aware of its presence among us. It's like water to the fish, the last thing we'd notice. But unlike sexual orientation, homophobia is contagious. Children can catch it from an adult. In fact, that's the main mode of transmission. Its effects range from mild distaste to homicidal rage, from judgmental attitudes to obsession. In its more virulent stages, it causes at least 100 people to commit murder in the United States each year, and maybe 1,000 others to attack fellow human beings, simply because the victims are homosexual, severely enough to put them in the hospital. The Houston Police Department didn't believe that sort of thing went on, despite repeated requests by the gay and lesbian community for better protection. Finally, in August of 1991, the department agreed to send out decoys, male officers in civilian clothes, walking in pairs, to the areas of alleged danger. In the first week, 4 of the decoy officers were attacked. two were tear-gassed, and two were beaten with a baseball bat. In that first week, a dozen people were arrested in attempted assaults. In a classic understatement, a police spokesman told the press, "We certainly have been made more aware of the problems faced by the gay community." He goes on to say, however, but most effects of homophobia are not immediate nor spectacular. Young homosexual people struggling with sexual feelings they know are at odds with the culture around them grow up with feelings of desperation, rejection, and low self-esteem that they often don't express, even to their families. He goes on to talk about some of these things. One of the interesting things about homophobia is that it actually can be studied. It can be measured. Sociologists and those who do social studies have been finding ways to measure homophobia to see if there's a real measurable phenomenon out there. And I just want to cite a couple different examples before we go into talk about what it is and how it operates. In one study, a psychologist prepared a tape of a counseling situation between a female client and a therapist. Then the tape was shown to more than 100 students who were preparing for professional work in therapy. Before showing the tape, the students were given a lengthy clinical history of the client who appeared on the tape. Half were told that the client was lesbian, and the other half were led to believe that she was heterosexual. All other information was identical. The differences between those and when they reported back were not only statistically significant, but dramatically so. For those who presumed the client to be lesbian, she was seen as more defensive, less nurturing, less autonomous, and overall less healthy. Yet for those who thought that the client was heterosexual, they were so positive in their response to her that they raised questions about why she was even in therapy in the first place. So when the only difference in information is giving was being led to believe that one was lesbian, one was heterosexual, all other things, the perceptions changed so radically that one was perceived as sick and the other was perceived as healthy. And this is a phenomenon oftentimes called as devaluing. When the only information we have about a person is that they're homosexual, we devalue them despite all the other empirical evidence that exists. There's another phenomenon that comes along with homophobia that's called avoidance. When we unconsciously or consciously seek to avoid people we perceive as homosexual. And the second test revealed that. A second test sought to see if not only were people being devalued for being gay, but whether people would actively seek to avoid them. It was a simple experiment. Subjects participated in a laboratory game with an imaginary partner, someone they could not see, but they could talk to. After the conversation with a number of questions, etc., they were given the choice of meeting the unseen partner. In nearly all cases where the unseen partner was described as heterosexual, they chose to meet them and to talk to them about the experiment. When the unseen partner, the same person, same voice and everything, was described as homosexual, the large majority of the persons chose not to meet the partner. Now, both of these are examples of homophobia, what we define sometimes as either the irrational or the non-rational fear of same-sex behavior or orientation. And the point is that homophobia is socialized into all of us as we grow up in a society that has a strong bias against gay, lesbian, bisexual people and the behaviors and values associated with that. What I'd like to do is to brainstorm examples together about some forms, the way about what homophobia takes, some different forms you may be familiar with. And I think one way to think of the pervasiveness of homophobia is to explore the losses or potential losses that lesbian and gay people have when they come out. But listen to me, when you think of homophobia, what are some examples of the forms it takes? And I'm going to simply jot this down here. We mentioned a couple. One is being devalued simply on the basis of being perceived as homosexual. Another is being actively avoided. Can you think of other ways that homophobia operates?
Taunts.
Karen? Taunts. Okay.
Taunts and harsh words.
Okay, so the part of devaluing is the actual taunts that go on, the harsh words that are being applied to people.
Jokes.
Okay. Would you say these jokes oftentimes build on stereotypes? There's a whole lot of stereotyping that goes on based on who a homosexual is, and then a lot of humor at the expense of gay, lesbian, or bisexual people.
Especially in kids.
Kids, particularly in kids. Let me ask the men in the room, were there particular places where you learned these kind of messages?
Playground,
all right? Playground is certainly one of them. We'll ask the women in a moment here too.
Locker room,
that's where I learned it the most. I don't know about others, but going through high school sports and whatever else became clear it was not okay to be gay if you were a man. How about women? Where did you learn some of these, as girls, as women, some of these stereotypes or attitudes?
Bathrooms? Graffiti in bathrooms.
Mm-hmm. It's an interesting one when you read the graffiti on bathroom walls, how those convey popular attitudes. Karen?
For me, it was pretty subtle, and I can't remember a particular thing, but as a little girl, it wasn't really okay to hold hands with other little girls or to wear yellow on Thursdays. And we didn't know. There were these myths around that had to do with same-sex friendships, and we didn't know what they were about.
How many of you learned that homosexual or a homo or a fag or a dyke or anything were bad before you knew what they actually were? I remember very well second grade on the playground. Two friends who were boys, and they were wrestling around. They started rolling on the floor, and people started calling them fags and homos. I had no idea what that was, but sure knew it was bad. Whatever it was, you didn't want to be it. And so I think some of these messages start very early. And then we begin to, when we get more information, we begin to associate them. And particularly then as people go through puberty, and if you discover through puberty that your primary attraction is to people of your own sex, you start equating all these horrible things that you've already had years of learning are bad with yourself. And that's where some of the crisis begins to come into play.
We had two teachers that lived by us that lived together, two females, that knew that they taught the same school, that they had to change schools that they were teaching at. Because people would talk.
Yeah.
And they're still good friends, they still live together, and they're not gay, but they were worried that that would be put on them.
Mm-hmm. So those perceptions there. And we oftentimes had ways, if you think back some of the other ways, the maiden aunts, the bachelor uncles, where there were safe categories to put them in as long as they didn't challenge those categories in that sense. Other things about how homophobia operates.
When you're a kid and you get toys,
mm-hmm.
and they're all segregated, and you're supposed to play with dollies and stuff.
Yeah, it's what I call sometimes gender segregation, but that you are given only certain roles or activities or toys or stories or clothes. And if you don't conform to that, if you want to cross that, you get those boundaries get policed.
And this woman was taking her. I think it was a boy to a toy store, and he wanted to go get, a girl toy, and she said, no, you can't go in that section, you have to go over in the boy section, just stuff like that. That really starts the segregation.
Yeah.
How about job expectations?
Job expectations. Yeah. Say more about that, Ellen, what you mean in terms of that.
Well, at least in my growing up years, if you wanted to do anything other than teaching, social work, it was very categorized. That's mm-hmm. what you went into if you didn't marry
mm-hmm.
or along with your marriage. I think it's expanded quite a bit,
yeah.
but there probably still are a lot of areas.
It's very interesting, too, how even when jobs have expanded, how much there are still heterosexual expectations if you're going to bring a partner to the Christmas party. You bring your husband or your wife. If you're going to, especially you see this in the church where we're getting away from this, but it used to always be that the pastor's wife played the organ, or played the piano or something. There was these assumptions that would come along with that. Yeah.
Sometimes there's an irrational jump that gets, as soon as there's a discussion at times, and it moves to the sexual abuse.
Yeah.
Real quickly, and there's kind of like a categorization that this is the cause of molestation and so on and so forth.
Yeah, I can't have a gay teacher for my kid.
Which is really interesting when you actually look at the actual studies.
Yes.
When well over 90% of pedophilia or sexual abuse of children is by heterosexual males, yet the perception is that somehow homosexuals are more dangerous around children. Yeah.
And
related to this, a fear mm-hmm. of homosexuals and however that is expressed.
Yeah. When I was talking a little bit last night about how this comes in, the fear factor, I think, is a helpful connection on this. That for, as lesbians and gay men and bisexual people contemplate coming out, it's oftentimes like dropping a stone in a lake and you have consecutive rings and you have to keep thinking in broader and broader things. So I just started listing for myself some of the things that you have to anticipate possibly losing or being affected by homophobia. And I came up with a very quick 10. We could come up with more of them, but employment. Lots of different possibilities about being fired, particularly if you're in a sensitive position like a school teacher, a pastor, those kind of things. Family, possibility about being rejected by family or being expelled by family. This is a big issue that I confront all the time with my students at Drake, who come to me and ask me whether or not they should come out to their parents. And I say, are you financially dependent on your parents to get through college? If you are, you really need to think seriously about the possibility of being not only being cut off by your parents, but losing your access to school, because I've seen that happen. Students come out and their parents kick them out of the house and cut off paying for tuition. So family, education, children, whether they're your own children or your nieces and nephews or the neighbor's children or the church school children, are you prepared to lose contact to children because of people's fears on that? Safety, are you prepared for the added risk of being a target of assault? For being either perceived or being known to be gay or lesbian. Mental health. And this is one that cuts both ways. There are tremendous mental health risks, I think, about staying in the closet. There's a whole other set of them that come from being out and being more directly targeted for the kinds of taunts and the abuse and the jokes. Some lesbian gay people have the ability to pass, what we call passing. Others have much less so, depending on their own lifestyle, manners, and these kinds of things. Some children have been taunted since first grade. Others make it all the way into their professional life without anybody be suspecting. But that, are you prepared for the mental health factors that homophobia causes? A loss of community, both residential community, faith community, community of peers. This is a real risk that homophobia affects. Credibility. Are you going to simply be categorized as a homosexual? Now anything you say is going to be filtered through that. That's one that I've had experiences in terms of job interviews, because I've been openly gay now when in my job interviews for teaching, and I've had some situations where a college president said to me, well, I'm concerned that you're a single issue candidate. The only thing you deal with is homosexuality, even though my vita, my publications, everything else showed a wide range of other things, the classes I taught, but I was perceived as simply being gay and that was it. Insurance, ability to get insurance, particularly for gay men, being perceived as a higher risk for AIDS and not wanting to have insurance on that. If you are partnered, you can't oftentimes be on your partner's insurance plan, planning for financial security. Housing. There are many places where you suffer discrimination, can't get housing or get expelled from housing. So these are just you start to begin to see the different areas of our lives. And homophobia, therefore, is not simply a cultural prejudice, but it's a cultural prejudice that affects all different dimensions of our lives. And it also, I think, strongly affects heterosexual people in terms of what heterosexuals are allowed to do in terms of expressing affection or intimacy with other members of their own same sex, where there may not be an erotic attraction, but whether or not two men are free to embrace each other, two women are free to walk hand in hand, exchange a kiss, we police these boundaries, whether or not you're heterosexual or homosexual. Homophobia exists to police these boundaries. Other thoughts or comments on some of that before I begin to just help us begin to categorize some of these? Are there things that aren't clear? Is this making sense in terms of some of the different ways that the effects these have? Yeah.
In your research, historically, is there kind of a wave of the height of homophobia and then kind of goes down for some years or decades and then rises again and so on? I mean, over a long period of time?
Well, I would say that homosexuals, like many other ethnic and racial groups and like women, have oftentimes been the scapegoats when times turn tough. If you look at the waves of homophobia, they're oftentimes coupled with economic anxiety, and so when there are other efforts to police society, so like the McCarthy era, and you have the whole scare about both communism but also about homosexuals somehow corrupting government. It's very interesting. There was very little said in this country about homosexuality during World War II, even though the military powers were well aware that there were lots of homosexuals serving in the military. As long as the war was on, it wasn't talked about. As soon as the war was over, you see a purging of the military. And you see this kind of up and down, depending on what's going on in society. The same way if you look at the burning of witches in medieval Europe, it oftentimes is associated with other anxieties, such as plagues, such as economic insecurity. You see this, I think that's a lot of what's going on right now, frankly, with the burning of the black churches. I think so many of the social insecurities, anxieties in other areas get projected onto convenient scapegoats. And lesbians and gay men have been some of those convenient scapegoats. We'll look a little later in terms of how that operated in Germany during the Nazi era, when some of you may be aware that one of the symbols in the gay community is the pink triangle. I'm going to sort of rob one somewhere along here. But you'll see lesbians and gay men sometimes wearing the pink triangle because our experience, not our, mine personally, but there were many, particularly gay men, who were rounded up as deviants during the Nazi period and were forced to wear the pink triangle as a sign of their crime of homosexuality, the same way Jews were forced to wear the Star of David, the yellow Star of David, and prostitutes wore a black triangle, some of these things. And that was the symbol of the crime. For lesbians and gay men, it's become a symbol of never again will we be silent so that we can be rounded up that way. Yeah, Karen?
I was just thinking of the dilemma of the fear and the secrecy thing, because I think the secrecy, which has been necessary so someone doesn't lose jobs and be harassed kind of thing, adds to how we don't know each other between the two communities, the heterosexual and the homosexual community. When I think of what I didn't know for so long, mm-hmm. and thought I didn't know a gay person, sometimes I put the load on myself and say, I must have been the kind of person that a gay person wouldn't come out to. Mm-hmm. And yet I don't know that that's always true. Right. I think there is just this, and that secrecy twists something.
Yeah.
It twists something within the person who has to be secret all the time.
Very much.
But it twists something in the culture between the two of us.
It's a very good point, Karen. It twists things on so many different levels. As you point out, it keeps the largely heterosexual society from really knowing or understanding homosexuals and homosexual culture. It keeps homosexual people from knowing each other. When we stay closeted, we don't know who we are.
And then that fear is...
And it becomes self-perpetuating. The longer you're in the closet, the more oftentimes those fears get magnified. There are terrible mental health repercussions of having to lead a double lifestyle and trying to keep these two worlds separate. So it operates at lots of different levels, and it perpetuates fear in both communities very much. Yeah, Sally?
Are you going to talk any time about where you think it comes from? I cannot wrap my mind all around where this inordinate fear comes from.
All right, well, you're the perfect segue. Let me sort of, and I'm the news Chris kind of guy, so I'm just put something. You weren't even a plant, but I want to just talk a little bit. A little bit about the forms homophobia takes, what are some of the responses, what are the behaviors, and then we'll talk a little bit about where it comes from. And then I do want to save a little bit of time talking about where is there hope in all of this. If we don't get it today, we'll look at it elsewhere. But homophobia, we're defining as the fear of same-sex behavior, orientation, or feelings. Fear of same-sex behavior, when you see people operating, even if they're heterosexual, if they're operating in ways that are perceived as same-sex. Orientation, feelings. And I would talk about the roots then being another term I'm not going to talk about as much today, but sometimes you'll hear paired together with this heterosexism, or sometimes we talk about as compulsory heterosexuality. That is, that people in our society are not allowed a process of discernment about whether they're homosexual, heterosexual, or bisexual, and therefore what's the healthiest form of relationship for each individual. Rather, everybody is channeled into heterosexual behavior and relationships. And heterosexism, that is, the privileging and the perceived superiority of heterosexuality and the enforced inferiority of other forms of relationship. So that being sort of the root here. There are a variety of different forms that homophobia takes. And I would say my guess is that most of us have experienced it at some point, and lesbian, and gay, and bisexual people included. One is fear that others will think you are homosexual. If you've ever been nervous at all about being seen publicly, with a friend who is known to be homosexual, or if you've ever been nervous about going into that section of the bookstore, or that section of the library where those books are found.
Or what color your suitcases are that you carry.
What color?
Or what color your car is. There's some people that
are wearing yellow on Thursday. Or, you know, all these things. But all the little subtle and not so subtle clues that society says it's not okay to be homosexual. Therefore, if you associate the fear that others will think you are guilty by association, that's one form. Secondly, one that's come out more in recent years is an awareness that most of us are somewhere on a spectrum between either absolutely heterosexual or absolutely homosexual, meaning that most of us at some point are going to have same-sex attraction and opposite-sex attraction. Not everybody, but a lot of us do. When you encounter openly homosexual people, for many people, it can raise fears, a fear of their own same-sex feelings and attractions. Does this mean I'm like that? Is this a natural thing? Is this an unnatural? So oftentimes, as long as nobody talks about it, as long as it's closeted away, you don't have to acknowledge that. But if you have, from time to time, same-sex feelings or attractions, or you wake up from a dream, dreams are the big catch-all because we can't control them consciously. So it's where all our closeted stuff sometimes comes out. But this is another way. And so people oftentimes, out of the fear of their own same-sex feelings, project the hostility onto those who are gay or lesbian. Fear of catching homosexuality. It's a pervasive fear among many sectors that homosexuality may be contagious. And we see, I think this is a big fear in the Christian right. Part of the reason why I'm seeing this a lot in the state of Iowa, because we have a very active Christian right there and a fellow named Bill Horn who produced a video called The Gay Agenda, that it builds a lot on this fear that if we allow homosexuals to exist publicly, they'll multiply. And your children will get caught up in it and they'll become homosexual. And I oftentimes think it's a fascinating betrayal of insecurity about heterosexuality. I mean, I have friends that are, you know, very dear friends who are heterosexual, and I keep saying, well, can't you just try to be homosexual? Just try it for a week. And it's like, it's just not who I am, you know? But people, this insecurity about heterosexuality sometimes, that somehow if we allow homosexuals to be public, everybody's going to become one, because it's just the cool thing to be. And then a fourth important form of homophobia is internalized homophobia. And this is particularly the case for gay and lesbian bisexual people. We all grow up with the same messages about homophobia that everyone else does. And so many of us have internalized feelings of inferiority, of not being worthwhile. And so you see, for example, higher incidence of self-destructive behaviors in the lesbian gay community, like alcoholism, like suicide, like substance abuse, oftentimes traced to these internalized feelings of self-hatred and inferiority when we take societal messages and internalize them. So these are some of the different forms it takes, some of the responses I mentioned. One is to see homosexuals as dangerous. Dangerous to society. And if they're dangerous, then you need to repress them. We need to keep them in check. And so this is the whole thing where you still see, this, for example, that some same-sex behavior, homosexual acts are still illegal in roughly half of the states of this nation. So that it's still seen as a dangerous thing for society, therefore you make it illegal to repress it. Second, closely related to that is that it's morally incorrect, a moral reprobation, and therefore all moral or ethical teaching then is opposing it, allowing it. It may not be illegal, but you don't allow it to happen morally. And a third one is stereotyping, that we handle our insecurities or fears through creating stereotypes and then categorize and project these stereotypes onto all forms of folks. So you can see varieties of different actions in terms of that. Stop me at any point if these are not clear or if you want other things. And I will also leave these newsprint sheets posted around, so if people want to come back and make notes on them, welcome to do so. Just quickly, we talked a little bit about some of the actual behaviors. If these are the attitudes and the fears, what are the behaviors? A key one, and this is a big issue for a lot of gay people, whether or not to come out, is the whole phenomenon of distancing or avoiding. Suddenly people are a little bit further away from you when you're talking to them. Or you feel the involuntary shudder when you know, before you always exchanged a hug or a handshake or a kiss, and now you're not quite so sure. So the distancing or avoidance. So the people you used to talk to once a week, now you may talk to once a month. So always, and you go through this constant mind game. Am I just imagining this, or is this really happening? Secondly, the whole phenomenon of discounting or devaluing. Of course he would say that. He's gay. of course she dresses like that. She's a lesbian. You know, it somehow becomes the source of everything we do now, the reason for who we are. And so our own beliefs, our things. I always find it fascinating that when churches discuss homosexuality, the big question is whether or not allow a homosexual to speak because they'd be biased. Heterosexuals are somehow seen as unbiased on this issue, even though it's our lived experience. And so you'll see this time and again when churches appoint study groups, raging debate. Do you allow a homosexual to be part of that study group? Because wouldn't that bias the outcome? And so we see heterosexuality is the unbiased backdrop, the norm, and homosexuality somehow is contaminated or biased. And that's a form of discounting or devaluing. A third one is actual direct hostility, scapegoating. You see a lot of blaming the victim here. Particularly, for example, in gay men who may have effeminate behavior, or lesbians who have may be perceived as more masculine. Scapegoating and then projecting hostility towards them. And this, I think, is oftentimes the root of the more actual aggression or anti-gay violence that is increasing in our society. Where when I was in New York, this was a big phenomenon of high school youth coming in from the suburbs of New Jersey, targeting gay and lesbian bars and then waiting with baseball bats and stuff and attacking people as they came out of the bars. But you're seeing this increasingly in lots of places, of the burning of bars, of attacking people. So it can go from very subtle distancing and discomfort all the way to physical aggression, violence, and attacking. And I think it's a whole spectrum in there.
Okay.
Yeah.
This is probably included in what you got here, but usually paranoia is another component in this, that we like to have control on our prejudices, and you can see if somebody's a different race. You can see if somebody's handicapped, you can see whatever it is, but the fact that you can't tell by looking is really unnerving.
Most of the time.
Most of the time.
Yeah, and then some of the times that you can, it isn't, and so on.
Right.
So,
that's a very good point.
Very
unsettling about it.
Yeah, because of the need for control.
Yeah.
And need to manage my prejudices.
It's a very good point. Let me just put up this next one here in terms of then what are some of the variables associated with homophobia along those lines that help us to understand it. Again, not an exhaustive list, but at least get us thinking about it. The number one variable associated with homophobia in society is not knowingly knowing somebody who's homosexual. The classic line, I've never met a homosexual. and when people say that to me, I listen to what they're saying and I say, well, what I think you really are meaning by this is you've never known anybody who you knew was homosexual. But I can promise you, it would be impossible to go through this world without knowing somebody who's homosexual, because we are sprinkled pretty much throughout the population. And unless you live the life of a hermit, has a heterosexual hermit. Other than that, you are going to have known people are homosexual, but the question is whether or not you knew it. This is the number one factor. Rates of anti-gay feelings drop drastically once people know somebody who's homosexual, especially if they've had a positive experience. Now, there are other times when it's a negative experience and that can increase it. The second factor is people who have a strong or low tolerance for ambiguity need to see the world clearly structured in black and white and a strong dogmatism, a belief that there is one way to do things and clear rules that have to be followed. That tends to be associated with an increase in homophobic attitudes. Connected to this is a third is the whole role of gender role rigidity. That a man's a man and a woman's a woman. And so we always talked about, a man works around the house, a woman works in the house. These kinds of attitudes that are breaking down quite a bit but are still pretty pervasive in our society, oftentimes more subtly than we're aware of.
But then when the family is disintegrating, then you can point to these other not being in the role models. That's what the rights say. The women are leaving the home, whatever.
Yeah, and then you get the blaming that goes on with that as well. But also increasingly, as we see more and more families that are headed by single parents, particularly women, where people are having to do the roles of both genders, we're beginning to see alternate role models as well in that. But if you come from a belief that there are certain roles that men have and certain roles that women have, and there's part of it's because there's a real conflation or confusion between gender and sexual orientation. And so someone who is a male homosexual is perceived to be identified with the female gender. and someone who's a female homosexual is perceived to be identified with a male gender. Whether or not there is that actual case or not, sometimes that's the case, sometimes it's not. Erica?
And then when you same-sex couples, it's like, well, who's the wife?
Who's the man and who's the woman, right. And you see the couples, then you still impose this kind of male-female gender roles on them. And there's a lot of humor around that in the lesbians and gay communities about that. And then the other thing they find is that, frankly, there is a correlation that men tend to have higher levels of homophobic attitudes than women do. I think there are a variety of reasons about this that we could go into more later. But one of them, I think, is women are given both more permission and more encouragement to be more relational early on. And men are oftentimes very, as boys, quickly distanced from their own feelings, not allowed to cry, have to be tough, and these kinds of things. And so don't have the tools oftentimes to confront difference creatively.
Just to add on to that, you can see that like with porn videos and just all this stuff with women together. And seeing and it's kind of a turn on for men, yeah. It's kind of turned into this like kind of thing. But with males, you hardly ever see that kind of media.
Yeah, good point.
Mm-hmm. You know, a rated R movie could show, and that all that stuff having to do with it.
Yeah, I mean we're touching on lots of different things that could be taken lots of directions because it's so pervasive in many areas, and pornography could be a whole other one to look at. Somebody was asking, where do anti-gay feelings come from? One of them, I think, is really what people around us say, societal attitudes. Now, of course, that begs the question, where do those attitudes come from? And we can talk more about that. But I think they're pretty pervasive in society in subtle and not so subtle ways, both by their absence, the fact that you very rarely ever see public images of homosexual people, particularly if they're perceived as normal homosexual people. And secondly, an instinctive bias against those who vary from societal norms. This is the same thing hits in race. Same thing hits in other areas where difference is perceived as problematic in that sense. And so that's where contact with people who are different can really break down barriers when we haven't had that. A very important one, I think, is sexism that pervades our society, the pervasive devaluing of women and the feminine. And therefore, this particularly, you see this in against both lesbians and gay men. This when you devalue women and the feminine, and then you have men who refuse to play the role of heterosexual men to keep this kind of system in place, patriarchal roles. They are seen as a threat to the society. Or women who are out overstepping their normal bounds, natural bounds, and acting like men, acting in leadership roles. This is stepping out, and so both have to be policed. Number four, this is an interesting one. We have a tendency oftentimes to genitalize thinking about homosexuals and homosexuality. What do they actually do? In ways that this doesn't happen quite as much, I don't think, in terms of, you know, this isn't the first question when a heterosexual couple gets married. Well, what do they do in bed? But this comes up a lot. Homosexuality gets reduced to, instead of being the full range of the complex emotions and feelings and intimacy that any couple experiences, it gets reduced to genital activity. And that leads to severe levels of anxiety and discomfort for many, many of us. I would say the words we use sometimes perpetuate these things. One of the ones for me, I do not like the term the homosexual lifestyle. One thing, I don't even know what it means. I mean, a part of it is because I guess I know so many different kinds of homosexual people that I can't even imagine creating one single lifestyle out of that. But if you reverse it, what does the heterosexual lifestyle mean? Uh-huh. And part of it is it takes, again, the full complexity of who we are as individuals and reduces it to something kind of faddish. Like, this is my summer lifestyle, and I'm going to put on my fall lifestyle. But the kind of words we use, I think, subtly condition us to think of homosexuals are somehow less than. Some of these we talked about, the need for simple black and white answers when everything around us is changing, particularly when it seems like social values are breaking down and you want some clarity. Karen?
Let me back up just a minute. I have the same discomfort with the word lifestyle, and for me, it seems to give permission for people to think you can choose it.
But you can, that it's a chosen
it's
lifestyle.
A chosen thing, and that is really misleading.
The whole question of choice is a fascinating one, and when people ask me about that, I say, my own experience, and I think experience of many, is I think very few of us choose our sexual orientation. The choice involves how we respond to it. Do we acknowledge it and try and develop it in healthy ways? Do we repress it and closet it? But the choice is not really what orientation we've ended up with.
I think our cultural use of lifestyle should have, and usually does have, more to do with money and possibility and economics.
Mobility.
And those kinds of things, but it sort of got moved over into this area that people didn't know how to talk about.
Yeah.
But it's really misleading.
And we use it oftentimes when maybe a more accurate thing would be culture, to start thinking about. I mean, I think there are distinctive things about lesbian culture, distinct things about gay culture, distinct things about black culture, distinct things about Norwegian culture. But you can't reduce Norwegians to a lifestyle.
It's a life.
It is a part of a life, yeah. Yeah, move along here.
Actually, I think you can with Norwegians.
It's more like a true Swede. Some of the other things here, just to quickly move through, the information we get about lesbians and gay men, and then especially about bisexuals, is selective and overwhelmingly negative. That is, you hear about the homosexual child molester, but you don't hear about the positive sides of things, and so we build up a selective database about it. Also, we oftentimes, and this, I don't much care for the term homosexual myself, because it oftentimes feels very clinical and abstract. But we tend to talk about homosexuality as an abstraction rather than Mary, Elizabeth, Charles, David, the real people involved. And finally, we just have a hard time in our society dealing with sexuality in general, in positive ways. And then to add on another level that seems threatening and unfamiliar makes it that much more difficult to think about.
Especially in the church.
Especially in the church. Especially in the church. With the risk of shortchanging some good conversation on this, I do want to, in the last 10 or 15 minutes, introduce at least some of the, if this is the problem that I think is fairly pervasive for why lesbians and gay men feel in exile. How do we respond to the biblical messages? I'd just like to talk a little bit about that. I think I'll just move this over to the center here, just to give us some sense of this, and we'll talk more about this as the week goes on. I think one of the real richness of the biblical literature, a lot of lesbians and gay men who leave the church don't want to have anything to do with the Bible anymore, which I think is such a loss, because the Bible is so full of stories of our ancestors who have confronted all these same issues in lots of ways and has a lot of wisdom. And one of them is the whole theme of exile. The theme of exile that is so pervasive for Jews, in particular because so much of their history has been spent in exile, is something that a lot of lesbians and gay men resonate with. My favorite is Psalm 137 in this, when Israel was taken, the people from Israel were taken out of the Holy Land into Babylon and were being tormented by their captors. One of the psalms that comes out of this here then says, Psalm 137, by the rivers of Babylon, there we sat down and there we wept when we remembered Zion. On the willows there we hung up our harps, for there our captors asked for us for songs, and our tormentors asked us for mirth, saying, sing us one of those songs of Zion. How could we sing the Lord's song in a foreign land? Is the question they wrestle with. How could we sing about God when we're now living in exile? And I think that this is oftentimes one of the most challenging issues for gay people of faith. It's a little bit different than the way it's framed there. Because for many lesbians and gay men, the tormentors are not foreigners. The tormentors are the people we're closest to. The people in our churches, the people in our families, the people we work next to. And secondly, there's no promised land that we can return to. There's no, I mean, even the one little effort there, I don't know if any of you ever heard about this, about 5 or 10 years ago, when there was an effort to buy a ghost town in Nevada in the middle of the desert, hundreds of miles away from any other town, and to make this a lesbian and gay town where it would be safe for people. They organized posses and vigilantes and came and burned it down. It was so threatening to have one place on the continent where lesbian and gay people could be in the majority and feel safe. So there's some difference here that lesbian people and gay people have to wrestle with. When we have no promised land to go back to, our exile becomes a permanent state. Mm-hmm. So how do we wrestle at a spiritual level with the anguish that comes within this here? that I say sometimes our closest historical parallel to what Israel was experiencing is the Holocaust, of being rounded up, identified, and being put in concentration camps. And, they, and again, just a little piece of historical trivia that you may or may not be aware of, that homosexuals were the one group of prison camp or concentration camp prisoners who were re-imprisoned by the liberating armies, where the Jews and the Gypsies and the others were set free. Homosexuality was still a crime in all four nations of the liberating armies, and so it was seen as a legitimate crime. And those, so you had a whole situation where people were trying to rip off their pink triangles to get away before they could be re-imprisoned, but there's actual footage of concentration camp prisoners being then re-imprisoned for being homosexuals. So this sense about there's no place to escape to get back to free ourselves from exile. Given that choice, if exile is where we find ourselves, what are the alternatives? John Schramm used to talk about this in terms of three possibilities. You can try to flee, although where do we go? Many of us do flee our communities of origin and end up in large cities to try to find some sense of anonymity. You can capitulate. You can pretend not to be gay. You can pretend to structure your life so that no, you stay in the closet. Or you can embrace the exile and find that as a place for spiritual growth and nourishment. And this is where I think that many lesbians and gay men have a strong affinity with the theology of the cross. When Jesus says, if you're going to follow me in the way of integrity, pick up your cross, but count the cost first of discipleship. And for me, this is where John Fortunato's book, In Embracing the Exile, really rings close to home. He writes it this way here, at the opening pages of his book here. He says, to be gay and Christian, integrating both into the wholeness we deep down know ourselves to be, to embrace them both as gifts of God and to live our lives authentically, rejoicing in those gifts as part of the uniqueness that makes us who we are, is to place ourselves on the outskirts of the community we most care about. It's beyond the realm of choice. Exile is simply where we find ourselves when we are who we are. It's most often a hard place to be. Banished. We come bearing gifts that aren't welcome. We come with love to give that's rejected. Outcasts. Despised and rejected of men, driven to the desert, or at least to that rather desolate ribbon of land that keeps the desert at bay. Yet God's charge is to all of us, too. Love them anyway. Loving anyway. Sharing anyway. Giving gifts even when no one wants them. Embracing the exile. It demands a profound belief that not only can life on the fringes be endured by gay Christians, but that being banished can be viewed as an incredible spiritual opportunity. To give and love while all the while being disdained as the most abject of people gives us such distinctive lampstands on which to perch our lamps that when our sisters and brothers see the light we emit and the good we do, they may even more profoundly give praise to God in heaven. Loving in the face of utter rejection means following in some of the most painful footsteps of Jesus the Christ. But I'm convinced that peace is to be found in accepting that calling, not peace in the everyday sense of tranquility, but the kind of peace that emerges from believing in our wholeness and the rightfulness of our place in the cosmos. Loving in the face of persecution may not always yield happiness, but it seems to be the only response that allows us to make any sense at all of our lives.
I wonder if they read that at St. Francis in San Francisco every Sunday.
Yeah.
When the one most wonderful Lutheran churches we have is living that.
Is living through that as a congregation, being sent to the exile. Several Baptist churches are experiencing it now. There's several it's very painful. There are several congregations who have been seeking ways to embrace their lesbian, gay, and bisexual sisters, and therefore it's no longer the individuals who are being exiled, but the whole congregations are being exiled by the denominations. And how do you make sense of that spiritually when you find yourself in that place? And when there doesn't seem to be a lot of immediate optimism for things changing right away. Hope, yes. I think the Spirit's on our side. I think there's long-term hope, but not much short-term optimism. I think it's going to get worse before it gets better in a broad sense. But that's why I think the Bible ends up being so important, because the Bible is so full of the testimony of people who found life in the most difficult of circumstances and found it by hanging on. Those Psalms, that Isaiah's passages, Jeremiah, Jesus, and talking about this sense of hope. Then the rest of the week we'll be looking at the stories themselves and where we find hope in those stories. But this raising this question then, and I just put a few of them here then, when the exile feels permanent, where do we find hope? How do we embrace the exile? And I listed a few things here, hope for beyond the exile. Well, let me just read one of them, Isaiah 56:1-8, because I think it's a wonderful thing here that talks about doing justice while waiting for the exile to end. If you're familiar with the book of Isaiah, you know the latter parts of Isaiah were written to the community in exile to keep the hope alive. And in Isaiah 56, he says, "Thus says Yahweh the Lord, maintain justice and do what is right. For soon my salvation will come and my deliverance be revealed. Happy is the mortal who does this, the one who holds it fast, who keeps the Sabbath, not profaning it, and refrains from doing any evil." Remember, he's saying this to the community that's in exile in Babylon. "Do not let the foreigner join to the Lord, say, 'The Lord will surely separate me from his people.' And do not let the eunuch say, 'I am just a dry tree.' For thus says the Lord, to the eunuchs who keep my Sabbath, who choose the things that please me and hold fast my covenant, I will give in my house and within my walls a monument and a name better than sons and daughters. I will give them an everlasting name and shall not be cut off. And the foreigners who join themselves to the Lord to minister to him, to love the name of Yahweh, to be his servants, all who keep the Sabbath and do not profane it and hold fast my covenant, these I will bring to my holy mountain and make them joyful in my house of prayer. Their burnt offerings and their sacrifices will be accepted on my altar. For my house shall be called a house of prayer for all peoples. Thus says the Lord God, who gathers the outcasts of Israel, I will gather others to them besides those already gathered." Why the emphasis on eunuchs and foreigners here in this message?
According to the law, they're outside of the covenant.
According to the law, they are to be kept outside. They're unclean. They're impure. And yet a funny thing happened in the exile. While Israel was in Babylon, foreigners started to worship Yahweh. Eunuchs, the unclean ones, started to worship Yahweh. But this raised a big question. What happens when we go back to Jerusalem? Do we kick out these new people who have now become part of our koinonia, part of our fellowship? And Isaiah is quite clear. God's covenanted relationship is large enough for all. All the outcasts are now part of the new vision. So we hold on to this vision of the new creation even while living in the times of exile. And that's why I give thanks for churches like St. Francis and the Baptist churches in Oakland and the other places that are being exiled but are still holding on to the witness. Because the promise, as I read it here, is that we're to continue doing justice and hope for the deliverance and salvation that God promises is sure. That's where I think lesbians and gay men find a lot of hope. Yeah.
And doesn't that story actually get worked out a little bit different? Where according to Ezra and Nehemiah, there gets to be the constraints actually when they get back there.
Yeah.
And they lose this vision.
Yeah.
And in fact, it becomes very narrow.
It becomes very narrow, and that again, I think, sets the context for understanding Jesus' ministry.
Right.
That Jesus comes back and I think brings the same message as Isaiah. And we'll look at that tomorrow when we start looking at the story of the compassionate Samaritan, what that tells us about this. We'll look at it in the story of the raising of Lazarus on Thursday, about what are the ways we can begin to see these same experiences being played out in our lives today in as lesbians and gay men and bisexuals and those who love us are engaged in trying to revitalize a sense of whole community. Well, I think we're out of time. I want to get people to lunch here, but thanks very much for joining me today again.